Karen, hello. We're talking about The Marsh King's Daughter. Is this your first novel?
Hi, Zinta. No, this is not my first novel. It's my fourth published novel, but it's the first in hardcover, and it's the first to receive, you know, so much attention. So in a way, it's like my first novel. It's also different than what I've written before, which, you know, sets it apart. It's a different genre.
Okay. Yeah, because I was looking online in your bio, and I didn't see other books mentioned. I did see blogs and essays and stories, that kind of a thing. What are your first books?
Well, my first two novels were published in mass market paperback by Berkeley in 2008 and 2011, and they're science-based thrillers, similar to what Michael Crichton writes. Like a lot of authors, when I started writing the kinds of books that I enjoyed reading, which were techno-thrillers. And then I have another novel that was a television tie-in novel. It's a work-for-hire project. That was a detective story. And then I got the idea for The Marsh King's Daughter. So when I got the idea for The Marsh King's Daughter, I actually woke up in the middle of the night with the first sentences of the book fully formed in my head. I wasn't dreaming about the character. The sentences were just there. And the sentences are, if I told you my mother's name, you'd recognize it right away. My mother was famous, though she never wanted to be. Hers wasn't the kind of fame anyone would wish for. J.C. Dugard, Amanda Berry, Elizabeth Smart, that kind of thing, though my mother was none of them. I thought, huh, well, that's interesting. This character is the daughter of a kidnapped girl and the man who took her. And so as I wrote up a few paragraphs in her voice the next morning, I could see that this book was going to be very different than my earlier books. It considers psychological suspense as opposed to the science-based thrillers. The other books are not bad books, but they're just different. So I don't actually recommend that anyone go back and read them because I'm going forward now. I think psychological suspense is what I really should have been writing all along.
Well, I have to tell you, Karen, when I pick this book up, it usually takes me maybe the week to read the book that I'm preparing for. Well, because of you, I did lose at least one night's sleep.
I'm so happy to hear that.
It was really hard to put down, so I almost made it to dawn that one night.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you have a way of doing a cliffhanger at each one, and you really want to know what's going to happen next. So I really enjoyed your book very much. So I do think you found your niche.
Yes, thank you.
What you've done with a lot of these chapters, you've begun with these excerpts from Hans Christian Andersen. How did that develop?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I basically got the idea for the book just out of inspiration in the middle of the night. The next morning when I wrote up those opening paragraphs, which are now still the first page of the novel, I gave the book a setting that I was familiar with, which is the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. But I still didn't have a story for this character. So it was at that point that I took my childhood fairy tale books off the shelf because I love books like A.1 Ivey's The Snow Child that offer a modern take or twist on a fairy tale. So I started paging through. Well, keeping in mind that I had already set this book in a cabin on a ridge surrounded by swamp in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, then I'm paging through the fairy tale book of tales, and I find The Marsh King's Daughter. So the fit was so perfect because The Marsh King's Daughter is about the daughter of a beautiful Egyptian princess and the evil Marsh King who takes her. And she struggles with this dual nature where by day she's beautiful like her mother but has her father's wicked wild temper, and at night that flips. And she takes on her mother's gentle nature in the guise of a hideous frog. So I used the fairy tale structure to form the backbone of the story. And that's why I actually included excerpts from the fairy tale at the beginning of the chapters that are set in the past that talk about Helena's story growing up. That's how the two came to come together like that.
Your knowledge of the UP is wonderful. I've lived up there for a short while and recognized a lot of what you were writing about. Did you spend a lot of time in the UP growing up, or how did you get to know it so well?
Thanks for the recognition on that, because the setting is one that I know very well. my husband and I, in the 1970s, we bought 10 acres west of McMillan on M28 in the Upper Peninsula, and we moved there with our infant daughter. She was 6 weeks old. We lived in a tent, and we built a little cabin out of wood and stone. We carried water from a stream, and we sampled wild foods. So we were part of that hippie back to the land movement, where a lot of young people in that era were wanting to live closer to nature. We only homesteaded like that for a couple of years, but we did live in the Upper Peninsula for 30, and we always had a real appreciation for the natural surroundings. So, you know, we learned the names of the plants and the animals, and we were able to recognize bird calls, and we know the rhythm of the seasons. So drawing on all of that knowledge to write this book was a real joy for me.
That was a joy for me as a reader. I'm just fascinated with people who have those kind of survival skills as your character did. So I was curious when I looked at your bio, I thought, oh, she lives near Detroit. How did this happen?
Right.
Now and then, unfortunately, we hear these real life stories on the news of people being kidnapped, women being kidnapped, girls, and being impregnated and that kind of thing. Did you look at those stories at all, or was this independent of that?
This wasn't directly inspired by those stories, but I do think a writer, everything that we read and know and observe and conclude, you know, becomes a part of us. And I've always been fascinated by stories of people who overcome a less than perfect childhood and make something out of themselves. I remember even as a child reading a Reader's Digest article story about somebody who had an abusive childhood, but then he and his wife went on to foster and adopt, you know, 300 children. And that sort of thing has always fascinated me. So I think that's where that came from as part of that initial inspiration. I did read J. Sudegard's story and also the story of Amanda Berry because I wanted to get a sense of what it was like to have a child in those circumstances. Obviously, my version is fictionalized, and it's very different than the real world stories, because in the real world, when this happens, the child is like an anchor for the mother, and she's very close to the child. Mm. I was writing pretty much the opposite. You know, in my story, Helena adores her father and feels a distance from her mother. So, yeah, it's a fictionalized version, but definitely those stories are out there, and they're super tragic.
And that added to the fascination to me that you chose to make her closer to her father than her mother. Must have been painful for the mother as well, but it made for a really intriguing relationship of love slash hate between her and her father, because she's growing up thinking that the way she's growing up is normal. She looks at the world through National Geographic magazines.
Right. And her situation is so unique because for, you know, her first 12 years, she lived in that cabin with her mother and father, and she never saw another human being.
Yeah.
So she had no one to moderate what her father was teaching her. There were no grandparents or teachers, or she didn't have television where she could see what would be considered normal behavior. So not only was she a natural tomboy and she loved, you know, hunting and fishing and foraging with her father, but also he cultivated that disdain for her mother because, you know, he had no regard for Helena's mother, obviously. So in that sense, Helena was a victim, but there's so few characters in the novel that it gave me a chance to explore the father-daughter relationship in almost with a purity that you wouldn't get if there were other people around her.
She grows up as a tomboy. I read somewhere online that you grew up as a tomboy, too.
I did. And I adored my father when I was little. So, you know, those parts were very delightful to write.
And then at some point online, you said somewhere that you, as you grew up, you began to see your father as a human being with flaws. And she seems to reach that point, too. Although it was interesting to me that she didn't reach it at the point where you would expect when finally she realizes that mom was kidnapped. And then you make that interesting point that, well, in her world, the way she's grown up, why wouldn't a man kidnap a woman for his wife?
Yes, and that's the thing. I think Helena is a surprising character to some people because she doesn't have what we would consider the normal reactions because she was raised under such odd circumstances by a man who basically was making her into a little version of himself. So it takes her a little longer to recognize how abnormal that upbringing really was. And I think that speaks to, like, all of our upbringings, as I mentioned and you refer to, as we grow up, we realize our parents are not as perfect as we think they are when we're little. And hopefully, you know, looking back as a parent, I can see times when, you know, I wish I would have done things differently with my children. But at the same time, I was doing the best I could with them at the time. So I think there has to be a lot of forgiveness on the part of adult children, you know, for how they were raised because, nobody's perfect. And Helena definitely had a less than perfect father.
So the gist of the story is, for our listeners, is he does finally go to prison after all these many years. He does get caught, and then he escapes. And she's the only one who has the same survival skill level that he does. So she's chasing him. But it's interesting to me that right up until the end, or hopefully I'm not giving something important away here, that love-hate goes back and forth, back and forth.
Helena's father, Jacob, tried to create a life for himself. He was like a mountain man, and he had the idea that he would have a wife and a family. And while he could control Helena's mother, because, of course, he dominated her and was you know, cruel to her in many ways, he couldn't control Helena, especially because he was raising her to be a version of himself. So that's one of the aspects of the novel that I thought was very satisfying, hopefully for readers as well.
What for you makes a good suspense story? Because you did an excellent job at that part. What do you look for when you read other suspense thriller novels?
I think the one element that I am pretty surprised. I don't mind being able to predict a list going, but then I like the unexpected. I'm also bored very easily. I'm that kind of person. So as a writer, when I'm working on a scene or a section, if I'm finding myself reluctant to write about it or getting bored with it, then I know I have to change something up. I have to have something in there that will surprise the reader and maybe spin the story off in an unexpected direction. And I think, you know, an example of that is what you mentioned before about how when Helena finds out her mother's kidnapped, she doesn't initially say, oh, poor mother, because her concept of what kidnapping is not the same as a normal person's would be.
And she was right. She made this observation that, you know, in some cultures, and her father did have Native American roots, that there were some cultures where that was normal, at least at one point in time it was.
Right. And so those were some of the ways where I felt like I could keep the story fresh. And that's what I look for when I enjoy a good book. I don't want to know what's going to happen next. It doesn't have to be edge of your seat suspense, but I just like to be surprised.
Now, also, you're I believe, a co-founder of the online writers community Backspace. Tell us about that.
Sure. Backspace started in 2004. I was living in St. Ignace in the Upper Peninsula when I started writing, and I didn't know any writers in real life. So I started connecting with other writers online, ended up partnering with my business partner. We set up the Backspace discussion forums as a private place where aspiring writers could talk. This was in the very early days of the internet. So this was before Facebook and even before MySpace. So it just provided a nice place for authors to help one another get published. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting because of those early members, many of them are now, you know, best-selling authors, New York Times best-selling authors, names that, you know, people would recognize. And we all basically grew up together and helped one another to get published. As an offshoot of the online discussion forums, I also organized and ran conferences for writers in New York for almost 10 years. And it was actually, the conferences were so successful, I almost gave up writing a number of times, which I think is interesting because bird in the hand, you know, the conferences were doing well and writing is such a speculative endeavor.
True.
But in the lead up to my 2013 writers conference in New York, I noted that an author who had gotten her agent at one of my previous conferences was coming out with her second book, and I hadn't written anything since then. And for me, that was my wake-up call. It just stung, and I said, okay, I'm not done with writing yet. So my business partner and I stopped organizing the conferences that year, and it wasn't that long after that I got the idea for The Marsh King's Daughter. So from a personal level, I'm very happy that I didn't give up on writing.
And you also organize some kind of a retreat on an island in the Bahamas?
Yes, that came about right before we decided to stop organizing the conferences. My business partner and I were approached by the owner of a private island in the Bahamas and asked if we would organize for them a week-long writer's retreat. And that was kind of a no-brainer. So we've done that for 3 years. I am going to do that going forward. We had to skip this year because I knew with my novel's publication, I would be too involved to be able to organize and run a retreat as well. But we're hoping to revive it for October 2018. It's just a beautiful setting, and it gives us, you know, I can bring top-notch faculty down. Lee Child was one of the instructors, Robert Gulrich, Taya Obrecht, Anne Hood. So it's just a really nice opportunity for people to be able to work one-on-one with some really outstanding authors and faculty. Yeah, so I would just like to say that, you know, the experience of first writing The Marsh King's Daughter and then seeing it published so well, not only in the U.S. and the U.K., but also translation rights have been sold to the novel in 23 countries altogether.
Yes.
The film rights have been optioned, so there's that. And then also the novel, a high point for me as a writer was that the novel got a rave New York Times review. So these things are so exciting, but they don't happen without readers and people loving the book. So I just want to thank the bookstore owners who've been hand-selling the book and the readers who've been enjoying the novel for helping to make all of this possible.